This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here, and I'm here, as always, with my friend and colleague, Susan Simpson. Hey, Susan.
Hi, Rabia. We're back again for another edition of the 45th quarantine.
You know, I was thinking earlier this week, if this nightmare ends, and by the nightmare, I don't mean the virus, I mean Trump.
I like the if you add in there, too.
Right. If, like, a year from now, there's a new president, are we done? Like, are we done with this? Are we done with our venting podcast?
I have not thought that far ahead.
A therapeutic podcast. Well, I was thinking about that, but anyway.
I mean, like, it depends on, I guess, on who wins.
There might be reason to, like, to continue.
Let's not commit one way or the other.
Right. And even if it is Trump, do we call it the 46th then? How does that work?
He's still the 45th.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. All right. Okay. So I want to start off with a little bit of a check-in. How are you doing?
I am mostly sane. I'm a little bit... It needs to get warmer. I need to go outside again.
Yeah. We haven't seen sun in a few days.
Yeah, it's like a bad combo. So, like, I haven't even wanted to go outside because it's so gross out.
Yeah. I would say that's the only upside. For me, when it's rainy like this, I feel like I want to kind of burrow at home under a blanket. And when it's sunny outside, I really do want to be out. And now we're not supposed to be. So that kind of sucks. But other than that, how are you and hubby coping? Everything going okay? You keep
pretty
each other sane.
We're having, yeah, he's an excellent cook. Like, I married the perfect guy for the apocalypse, for real. He's a great cook. He's
damn
game for anything. So, you know, I'm cruising through this. Although, well, I had a call from someone whose case we worked on for Undisclosed, our other podcast, and he was asking how I was doing last night. And I was like, how do you answer that question? Like, if I give you an honest answer, it's going to be like, oh man, I'm so cooped up in here. I'm like,
yeah.
As if they want to hear that.
Right. Well, I shared this on a WhatsApp group with a bunch of friends, and these friends are great. They're like trying to do Zoom meetings or even doing like workouts together. I have joined none of those, but my husband and I last night, we were kind of going over the different ways that we have contributed to our family's coronavirus preparation. And this is what I said in my message. I said, in the past 3 weeks, I procured a dozen Lysol sprays, fabric sanitizer, antibacterial lotion, copper bracelets and water bottles for my entire family, face mask making materials. Yes, we're going to make our own face mask. Disposable gloves, extra quantities of ibuprofen, acetaminophen, and cough meds. And my husband has learned how to solve the Rubik's Cube. So.
Well, at least one of y'all is being useful. See, now I feel less. I was thinking I was doing really good because we couldn't get a thermometer and we couldn't buy one anymore because they're all sold out. So yeah. I've been using a meat thermometer.
Hey.
And I thought that was a good MacGyver move. But
hey, I think that, does it work?
It does if you're very careful.
Oh God, what does that look like? Where does it go, Susan?
Just very carefully under the tongue. Hope you don't like, you know, stab yourself and go to the ER.
You know what? I think that's. I was looking for a digital thermometer too, but I know I have a meat thermometer somewhere in this house.
Can confirm it works. Just be careful. All right.
Yeah. I mean, generally speaking, after mothering three children, like, I am one of those people, I can touch your forehead and I know. I just know. I don't know exactly what the, but I know if it's a low fever, high fever, I got it. All right. So, by the way, we're going to be going over some stuff, but then we're going to be joined towards the end of this call, hopefully, if all goes well, by the spouse of a friend of the show, Wajah Ali's wife, Dr. Sarah Qureshi. She was recently on CNN, and she is not just a physician, but she's also had a remarkable career doing like public health work. She's a professor at Georgetown Medical, and she's just lovely. And so she's agreed to come on and talk to us about some of the issues and questions we might have and our listeners might have. So I'm excited to have her on later. But let's get kind of into it. I want to start off by talking about where we are right now, what the numbers look like today. By the way, I am firmly in the camp of the governors might save us from Trump, but I want to share a good resource with our listeners, which is nga.org, which is the National Governors Association. They've got a lot of great resources on there. It's a good kind of one-stop place to get a lot of data. We are at a little over the 54,000 tested positive cases in the United States right now, about almost 500,000 worldwide. Total deaths in the U.S. are 737 as of a couple of hours ago.
Yeah, Yeah, but I will say it's kind of curious that at least going by the CDC's reported numbers, I mean...
These numbers are actually taken from the CDC. These two figures, yeah.
And we're seeing like scary increases, but for the past like 3 or 4 days, it's been a very steady, almost exactly 10,000 new cases a day, every day.
Which is weird because it should be exponential.
We know we have exponential growth of these cases in the U.S., but at least the way, maybe it's just a temporary trend. We'll see what happens. I mean, I guess if it stays there forever, we're doing better than we could be doing. But I think it's more an artifact of the fact that the U.S. numbers have basically, it does feel like what in the U.S. we're tracking is not coronavirus cases. It's our capacity to test for coronavirus cases.
Yeah, yeah. And we're going to talk a little bit about where that capacity is and what's going on with that later in the show. But I, at the end of last week's episode, because I kind of caught my breath when you said it, you said that you think around we're going to probably lose about 1 million American lives. Now, I did not at that time, I thought that was shocking. I did not at the time know that the Imperial College of London had released a study, I think in the last week, that according to their predictions, first of all, by the end of June, for every available critical care bed, there's going to be 15 patients, COVID patients, that need that bed. And by the end of the summer, the pandemic might have claimed about 2.2 million American lives, which is insane.
And that is a kind of a not worst case scenario, but that's a bad case scenario. And I mean, all the models at this point, just we don't have any way of knowing.
I don't know. Do we really not, Susan? Because is there any way? We don't. We are way past any kind of good outcome given.
We're not. Well, how do you define a good outcome? It's kind of what we're looking at now.
A good outcome to me, the best outcome to me would be best practices, which is like a national lockdown. We still have every state on its own. In every state, counties are doing differently. You've got governors and you've got mayors saying you got to defy orders from, you know, I mean, like people are like scrambling basically because what we're hearing from the White House is disastrous. And so we don't have a national response. And other countries have produced national responses, like China, like Singapore, like Italy. And so everybody's kind of on their own. So we know that's not a great practice. And also, we're not testing the way we should. We don't have the supplies ready. Trump has set up literally a Hunger Games for the states. He has set it up so that he's like every state, every governor on their own is responsible for getting their own supplies, you know? Like outbid each other, compete against the federal government, everybody reach out to other people in the world and try to get your own supplies. This is a disaster. We are in the middle of the worst kind of responses to this crisis, so we should expect the worst outcome.
Well, so here's a best case scenario that we could look at. No, I mean, it's not a great scenario, but like if every remaining break broke our way, let's say, for instance, that the states get their act together better and are more effective imposing a shutdown. They'll never have a fully effective one, but even the ones we've got going now, they're kind of partial, at least in some states. I think there'd be sufficient to sort of blunt the worst effects. I mean, I think New York's, I don't know if there's any good outcomes there. But for other states that are not quite at that level yet, if the virus turns out to be even more susceptible to warm temperatures and humidity than we think it is already, and if perhaps the asymptomatic transmission is way higher than we already think it might be, mm-hmm. And if they fast forward the vaccine trials as fast as humanly possible, they are doing that, and they break all records and somehow get a safe enough vaccine and can produce it in vast stocks by October before the second wave hits, I mean, yeah, we could, that might be it'll still be bad, but it won't be like that bad relatively. But again, that's all depending on like external factors other than the vaccine. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about those external factors. This is a segment that in our draft I call the stupid. And this is how...
First even, line, everyone loses yes. in the coronavirus challenge.
Yeah, everyone loses in the coronavirus challenge. I didn't even not know this was a thing.
This is not true. Dogs are winning.
Are they?
Dogs are freaking winning the coronavirus challenge.
Because dogs maybe can lick a toilet seat and be fine. But
no, because they're getting all adopted. And because people are home all the time hanging out with them. So the dogs love this shit.
Okay, maybe that's it. But the coronavirus challenge is actually people online, young people usually.
Oh, God, dog. Let's not talk about that. That's so gross.
Oh, Susan.
I saw a video and I, like, wanted to die.
They're licking toilets.
Oh, that's, like, coronavirus would be the least of my concerns. That's not even how it spreads.
I know. I know. It's what about, like, the fecal matter challenge? Anyway, a number of them have ended up hospitalized. Then you've got like, then you've got people, and I, and you know, this is, seems like where Trump is going towards. We laughed at Boris Johnson last week talking about, like, oh, may, or it was maybe 2 weeks ago, saying we should try herd immunization. Everybody get infected. Well, just like yesterday, the Federalist, which is a very well-known, well-read conservative outlet, published a piece in which a contributor wrote that an out-of-box solution is controlled infection. We should have coronavirus parties, and people have been having coronavirus parties to get infected, thinking if you're young, you get infected, this will create an immunity, you're not going to get sick and die, although there are young people dying from this every single day. And so they tweeted this article out, and you know, Twitter actually shut down their account and removed it, which is great. But this is a thing that's happening. And already there have been reports in Kentucky of people who had a coronavirus party and people got sick from it. All right. So we're all in the middle of quarantine life. And one of the toughest thing that's happening nowadays, a lot of us are feeling financial impacts. A lot of people are losing their jobs and are looking for, you know, a little bit of help getting through the next few months. And so I'm really happy that we have back on as a sponsor this week, Lightstream. They've been with us before too, and they are a great way to basically get you through some tough times.
Especially now, a lot of people are carrying balance on their credit cards. And if those cards come with high interest rates, you need our friends at Lightstream.
Yeah. With Lightstream, it's easy to lower your interest rate, and you can get a Lightstream credit card consolidation loan. You get a low rate as low as 5.95 APR with autopay. And Lightstream is a division of SunTrust Bank, which, you know, a lot of us know and trust for many years.
Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000, and there are absolutely no fees. You can even get your money as soon as the next day as you apply.
So apply today to get a special interest rate discount and save even more. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/45th. That's lightstream.com/45th.
Subject to credit approval, rate includes a 0.50 auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/45th for more information. So a couple weeks ago, I was thinking, like, I'm not thrilled exactly with we got Trump of all people leading us in a time of crisis like this. But I was like, you know what? I kind of almost think we're a bit better off than the UK, because what the UK's government was doing was even more batshit insane. So as bad as it was here, I was like, well, we might not be the worst stuff after all. And then suddenly the UK comes to its senses, like, oh, my God, this is terrible. This is not going to work at all. What the hell are we doing? They reverse course. They immediately try and repair the damage they've done. And at the same time, the U.S. takes the exact opposite approach and, like, is now trying to end all the good stuff it did and is trying to invite disaster.
Yeah. It's not even the U.S. It's just one person. But it's interesting to watch everybody line up behind him, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But I want to talk about this story, which is, I think, crazy, because in Arizona, a man and his wife, he died. The wife was hospitalized. What they did was they listened to the president. The woman told NBC News that she heard Trump make repeated mentions of a drug called chloroquine. He said it in White House briefings, and so apparently she's like, oh, this is the kind of stuff that I use to treat my koi fish pond. And so her and her husband took it. He died from it, and she was hospitalized. She survived, but she's very sick. But this is something that Trump more than once has been, he said it in the White House briefings. He's tweeted about it. When Dr. Fauci was asked about it at one of the briefings, he tried to deflect. He went on Laura Ingraham a couple days ago. He was doing the rounds of Fox News, and she's like, wouldn't you just say it's better to, like, try it, take it? And she was just trying to get him to agree to what the president, like, the Trump does this over and over. He says the most ridiculous things, and then the people around him have to twist themselves into pretzels to conform with that bullshit. So Laura Ingraham was trying desperately to get him to say it. And he's like, look, I would take it if it was in a controlled clinical test situation.
Yeah.
And that's it.
It does kind of remind me of the old stories about how The Apprentice worked, where they'd have an episode and all the challengers would do some, like, business task. And then Trump would come in and, like, fire one of them. And he just would so often fire someone, like, for no goddamn reason, that the people doing the, you know, the editing and the slicing would have to try and, like, reconfigure the entire episode to explain why Trump chose a totally wrong person to remove from the show.
Oh, my God. I did not know that happened.
Yeah, like he just like fires someone who did totally fine all the challenges. So they have to like go through and edit it and are like, actually this person sucks somehow.
Oh my lord. Yeah. Well,
and they've actually watched The Apprentice, so I don't know how it worked, but I'm assuming that's kind of like the basic.
Man, back in the day I used to like, I think the first couple of seasons I enjoyed it. And you know, he was just, he fit perfectly in that role. I just didn't imagine where we are today.
So any, well, the hydroxychloroquine thing is, it's really horrifying how much Trump has just repeatedly come out and be like, oh, it's a game changer. Like, it'd be a gift from God. It can change everything. It can make it all go away magically. The evidence he's based it on is like some Reddit post that has like a chart of like some stupid, like, not stupid. I mean, it was a study, initial study. I mean, we're in a pandemic, so like, I'm not criticizing
it. It was a Reddit post?
Well, that's like where the graph was like being passed around and where all the Trumpy people saw it. But the study itself was just a very temporary, like, here's like a, here's an idea to look into. Here's like a limited study we had in a very small population. But even that study actually excluded like 6 or 5 of the patients who had bad outcomes, including one who died. So,
oh my God.
Even it's data that shows like a, it's kind of questionable, like data for what it is. And it was never reporting to be proof of anything. It's not proof of anything. It's basically, here's something to look into, someone do a study to figure it out. And guess what? Studies are being done. There were already clinical trials underway before Trump got on this bandwagon and started hyping it. And then caused everyone to do a run on this drug. So people who need it for other treatments now can't get it. And poor people, like the couple in Arizona. And by the way, like a lot of people, like a lot of the conservatives on Twitter and whatnot were like, oh, the fake news media is all saying like, oh, Trump caused this to happen. But it was fish tank cleaner they took. Like, why do you think people were concerned about what Trump was saying? They weren't concerned that Trump was hyping this drug because they thought that, like, responsible doctors were going to, like, just massively overdose people. No. They were concerned by exactly the scenario. The drug the couple took was the same. Like, it was a drug. It was the same drug. It was obviously not the human form of it. But it wasn't a different kind of drug. It was just one intended for clearing up fish parasites, supposed human ones. So, like, the idea that this would happen is totally predictable. I just hope it doesn't happen again.
There's a doctor on Twitter in response to Trump saying that, you know, this is a game changer. Is like, you know, if you take these drugs, and for some people, it could actually cause heart failure. Like this combination of drugs that he's saying is a game changer.
Oh, yeah. And a new study done, again, small sample, so who knows, found no effect from the drug.
Awesome. Okay. More stupid. Liberty University, which is, you know, the Christian University, Jerry Falwell, reopened its doors after spring break this Monday, meaning 2 days ago. So he's like, everybody comes back. Students have come back to live on campus. They expect the entire faculty to be back. They are there. There's an ongoing petition. But there is this whole kind of conservative shift. I even read the most wacky evangelical article that I'm going to talk about later, like kind of lining up behind Trump saying that, you know what? We cannot put the world on hold. We should not put stuff on hold for the sake of human lives. So yeah, when you've got tens of thousands of students at this university, they're coming back from spring break, by the way, and might have to go back home maybe in the next month or two, or at least when summer goes out. That is a shit show. That is a massive shit show waiting to happen. But and then I wanted to talk a little bit about Ron Paul. Ron Paul, whose son is Rand Paul in the Senate. Not long ago, Ron Paul, he has his own blog. He wrote a piece in which he called the pandemic response, all the concerns, a hoax. He called Dr. Fauci the chief fearmonger. He said this is all just like some kind of plot. And then 2 days later, his son tests positive for coronavirus, who, by the way, was the only senator who voted against a coronavirus relief bill. So,
like, I absolutely do not wish this on anyone at all. But the fact Rand Paul was the first guy in the Senate to get it is definitely the most hilarious outcome.
It is. And you know who tested negative is Mitt Romney, right? So, and did you see Trump's tweet about that?
I mean, it's, what a child.
He tweeted this morning that he was so happy he didn't have words. It was such bullshit. He's like, you know, he was a terrible senator and a failed presidential run. But I'm so happy I don't have words.
It turns out that despite all of his bizarro and nasty tweets and his total fuck up on how he's handled the virus, luckily for Trump, this has all been great for him, at least for his approval ratings. He is now has more approval than he's ever had at any other point in his presidency.
How does this happen?
The same way that it happens for any president has a crisis hit the nation. Rally around the flag.
Okay. But the flag is going to kill you in this situation. And there, you know, it's interesting though, he has been doing a lot of framing about, you know, calling it an invisible enemy. Like he said, he declared himself to be a wartime president.
Mm-hmm.
so has that effect, I guess.
And also, adding on to that, he's having these daily or twice daily sometimes press briefings that are aired in full on most channels of him just spouting the worst, most nonsensical lies, claiming he's done all kinds of great things that never happened and all kinds of amazing things happened that never happened. And probably the biggest part of it is, like, where the hell are the Democrats? I have no idea. I mean, I know where they are, but, like, they're not doing anything on this. They're not doing it. I mean, they feel constrained. They feel that they cannot attack the president in this time of national crisis.
Like, on the messaging or counter-messaging?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Politically?
They are just not, and I guess they've made a decision. They cannot be seen as, like, attacking the president right now, which I guess, I mean, they're the experts. Who knows? But it certainly feels like they've ceded the entire ground to Trump, even though he is an ongoing danger to us. They're like, oh, we can't criticize the fact that he is, like, now going to cause a million people to die because we're in a crisis.
Well, I know Bernie Sanders has been having, I think almost nightly, like these live streamed talks or briefings or something, talking about coronavirus and other issues. And after what seemed like a very long silence from Joe Biden, he finally popped up a couple days ago. I think it was Monday or Tuesday. He gave like a little video. And then I think he's done a couple of interviews. They haven't gone great though. I don't know what's happening with Joe Biden. He just seems kind of disoriented to me. I don't know if it's just me. I am concerned, however.
I'm not concerned about him being disoriented. I'm not concerned about that. I do think it's a hard time for anyone who's on the campaign trail right now to take a position. Like, it's hard. It's probably easier for people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, because they're, you know, senators who are actively working to fight this. For someone on the campaign trail who's not actively in government and can't actually do shit, it is a difficult place to be in.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that is where the Dems are, by the way. And let's get to that now. This coronavirus relief bill, we've been hearing about this for the last week, that something's going to, you know, there's a number of different, like, plan proposals. You know, it's going to be a $1 trillion bailout, $2 trillion relief bill. They were supposed to take a vote today. I don't even know if it happened. The Senate was supposed to vote on a bill that I think the House sent over. Or was it a Senate bill?
Technically, it's still scheduled. Well, last I heard it's scheduled, but it wasn't looking great. And be totally honest, I don't even care about the bill. It's a huge deal. It's $2 trillion. It's a big deal. It's very important, all that. I have, like, lost all interest or ability to care about it because that's not true. I still follow it a lot. But, like, on a bigger scale, just, like, everything they're doing is so insufficient for the moment that it's hard to get emotionally invested. Other than the fact that there was the $500 billion slush fund that was going to have complete Treasury control about where it got dispersed to and no transparency for 6 months, I'm still not convinced the Democrats aren't going to, like, screw us all over and allow that to go through somehow. But, like, at least that was the line Democrats were drawing. They're like, nope, this is not what we're going to, like, allow. Right. This is,
as of last night, I was told that it was removed. That provision was removed.
Well, they now have, like, a independent oversight. It's supposedly been written into it. Right. I've not seen the provisions, but, like.
But also there's a provision that was added that said that no companies that were connected to or overseen by anybody connected with the executive branch, members of Congress, anybody in the their spouses, their in-laws, their children, all of those. Like, there's a whole category that no companies that were owned by or overseen by or whatever had some connection could receive any of these bailout funds or loans.
Not any of them. Some of them. There are other funds that actually they could still avail themselves to. But the reason the slush fund that was under direct Treasury control and so bad is that, and that, like, until now, from now until the election, essentially no business could have afforded to criticize Trump in any way or take a position opposed to him. Because guess what? They would just be signing away their ability to get relief funds.
Right. And it was kind of like, I mean, these people are so, like, they're thinking every, you know, they're like, for 6 months at least, like, it would be confidential. Whoever Steve Mnuchin decided to write a check to. Insane. Just waiting for the election.
And there really wasn't a lot of Republican support for that part of it. A few of the senators in their, you know, speeches and all that were like, you know what, that sounds, having oversight doesn't sound so bad to me. So it wasn't even like it was a huge, important piece of this for Republicans on the Hill.
Look, I gotta say, I've been looking longingly over the border at Canada. Like, why haven't I moved yet? I think almost every day, Justin Trudeau gives these amazing, like, online little messages to the country. But, you know, they're providing basically all their families like $2,000 a month, 6 months of mortgage and rent freezes, extra. People there get something called a baby bonus. If you have babies, you get money from the government just for having babies. They're going to increase the baby bonus. And, of course, their health care is already covered. Now, here, what I'm understanding is that it's like $1,200 per person, or there's like a total for a family.
One-time payment. They'll come in like 4 months.
One time payment. There's no freeze on mortgages or rent.
No, and there is some, like, some of the uninsurance compensation is in there, and that would be ongoing. But it's also now a sticking point, because some low-wage earners could theoretically, after being laid off, receive more income from this package than they would from their jobs, which is why the Republican senators have now revolted and are refusing to sign the bill.
Oh, yeah. Lindsey Graham gave an impassioned speech. He's like, you know, there are people who could, from, like, you know, this package, would be averaging $24 an hour when they've never made $24 an hour. And I'm, like, so disgusted by this reprehensible human being. Like, you know, if there are people who have been, like, low-wage earners for years, and you're saying you don't deserve this, even in a time of crisis for a limited period.
When they've been laid
period,
off, like, they didn't choose this. They actually they have to be laid off to get this.
Yeah, and you still have all your expenses, and this is not forever. And I just was shocked watching that video. I really was horrified.
I mean, the plan was for them to sign this in, like, recess for, like, what, I don't know, a month or something insane? So if they don't get this through, I mean, it's... I mean, we're in trouble. It's not.
And apparently they're going on, they're leaving. Aren't they going on vacation?
Well, that's what their plan was. We'll see what happens if they can't get this bill through.
Well, what is the wall you're talking about here? I see.
Oh, yeah. It was someone took the time to write into the you know, it's hundreds of pages long. It's a big, complicated mess. It's moving, like, everyone on the Hill is, like, trying to get this thing through, and no one knows all the pieces. But someone did think to include a provision that's like, oh, by the way, Trump cannot try to divert any of these funds towards his wall.
I'm glad somebody thought of that.
Yep.
Oh, God. Okay, so, and the corporate bailout are really the biggest pieces, I understand, of all this.
Yes. Which, you know...
I read today that the Kennedy Center is getting $25 million. Of course, again, the vote hasn't been taken.
Yeah,
so we
but
don't know
also, the Kennedy, I mean, it's not like it's the most important thing there, but the Kennedy Center is a, like, Congress has oversight over it. The people there wouldn't have money, like, it has employees, this keeps them funded. I mean, it's
but
not.
But they have a budget because they are a government, because they're, I mean, they already have a budget for the year.
But now those employees, not,
those employees would have gotten paid anyways. I don't understand that, so. Okay, very recently. Okay, Trump has really, in the last two or three days, suddenly kind of shifted course in terms of, like, he was really kind of sober and somber the last few days of last week. All of a sudden, he's like, enough of this bullshit.
He got bored.
He got bored. And, you know, he's feeling very dull on the inside. I think kind of like you, Susan.
my notes.
Yes. All inside, no play makes Susan a dull girl. Yes, oh, she repeats it four times. Okay.
Have you seen The Shining?
I have, but it's been so long. It's like 20 years. I don't remember it much. Yeah. Much at all. Yeah. Did
but
they say that?
Point being, Trump wants this thing to end now. He's ready to, like, go through a door with an axe because he, at one of his quote unquote town hall on Fox yesterday, he announced that he's now, like, basically done with this whole shutdown thing. And in fact, he has the perfect date for when to end it and to have everyone go back to work and resume life as normal.
Easter's a very special day for me. And I see it's sort of in that timeline that I'm thinking about. And I say, wouldn't it be great to have all of the churches full? You know, the churches aren't allowed essentially to have much of a congregation there. And most of them I watched on Sunday online. And he was terrific, by the way. But online is never going to be like being there. So I think Easter Sunday, and you'll have packed churches all over our country, I think it would be a beautiful time. And it's just about the timeline that I think is right. It gives us more chance to work on what we're doing. And I'm not sure that's going to be the day, but I would love to aim it right at Easter.
Easter is very special to him, apparently.
Oh, yeah. It's like, okay, like, I hate this phrase. It's overdone. But, like, can you imagine if Obama did this? If Obama used Easter for something that he, like, about right. him and his, like, policies, the world would explode.
Well, there was some Fox, one of their anchors was like, oh, yeah, the great resurrection of America. Oh, you know, like, this is going to, like, the Lord risen from the dead.
You know, on the other hand, just thinking this through, as bad as it is to have Trump in charge right now, can you imagine what would happen if Obama was in charge and he tried to institute a national quarantine or tried to encourage states to do that? There would have been revolts. There would have been, like, it would have been, like, Jade Helm times 100.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right. The thing is, if Trump were to do that, basically everybody would be okay with it. You know, Democratic government, like everybody would just enforce it, institute it. Yeah, you know, like
there's mass support for the quarantine, for the shutdown, whatever you want to call it. Like people are understanding why it's necessary, and there's not political pressure for him to for this to stop. And in fact, Trump's powers to stop it are pretty limited as they are. But the idea that like one, we can just choose a date, like even pick any kind of date, certain. And say, oh, we're going to open things then. And have it only be 2.5 weeks away is insanity. Also, the idea that he's going to freaking have like, the churches packed. Like, do you want to kill everyone who goes to Easter church service in America?
Or, do you want to kill your own base? I don't understand. Like, I feel like this message, I'm like,
it's science denialism. It's not just that he's like, I think part of it's like he's convinced himself this is not a problem. So he wants people to like act on that as well. And to prove, he wants like a show of like, unity and respect and like deference to him, and people prove that they're not scared of the virus by going to church on Sunday.
Here's the thing. People are wondering why he did this. I think it's pretty clear. He's suffering. I mean, like the economy is obviously crashing. It's going to crash. It's going to happen. It's going to be worse if we don't slow down the virus, if we don't, you know, flatten this curve. But also, six of his top seven revenue earning properties are now shut down because of the coronavirus. Oh, yeah.
The president could very much go bankrupt during this.
Right. And he's tweeted twice and said on these briefings, we cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself. To him, the cure, meaning him losing money, is worse than people dying. That's how I see it. I don't think there's anything beyond. It's all about money for him. It's all transactional for him.
It's a death cult. And it's really shocking to see how quick a large segment of the population in the United States is on board with this. Like the idea that you can get
people
go on TV and be like, oh, yeah, let's let people die for the greater good. I'm like, well, in this case, it's like self, like the people who are dying are like people saying it. But that kind of energy, you can see how easily it could get pointed at another group. Yeah, if they're that willing to say, like, I'm willing to risk my grandparents for this, well, why wouldn't they be also saying, oh, if I could risk this minority group, why wouldn't I do that? I mean, in this case, there's no minority group you can sacrifice. But, like, the fact they're so eager to jump on it, even when it's themselves are sacrificing, is the horror part for me.
Man, this one guy, I can't remember his name, Scott something, he's like a right-wing or conservative pundit. He tweeted...
Oh, the Federalist dude?
Right, exactly. He's like, well, look, you know, it's going to mostly impact people who are not very productive anyways and are old anyways. So it's just like, you know, this is not like, and somebody else was like, I can't remember who else, but you're right. Everybody's kind of lined up behind Trump on this. And so this other guy was like, well, you know, if I could give my life, I would, you know, to save American values of what? Of going back to work, of capitalism. But the problem is you cannot choose who gets the virus. I know they wish they could choose, but you can't.
Also, the whole idea that it's like a choice between like lockdown and saving people versus saving the economy, having to go to work, that's a fantasy that they've come up with to convince themselves like here's a solution. You cannot have a normal functioning economy when you have millions of people being hospitalized, hospitals overrun, can't keep up adequate care. Like, you can't have a functioning economy in those circumstances. Like, what the alternatives they're trying to choose between don't exist.
What if, Susan, what if this ends like this, where progressives and Democrats continue to socially isolate and distance and take all the precautions, and Republicans don't because he's got such a high approval rating, they'll do whatever he says, and then they all just die off? I don't know.
Well, the good news is that at least the conservatives are in, like, more rural areas. So the inherent danger is a bit less. If it was the reverse, if people in the like cities were refusing to quarantine, we would just be fucked.
There's also, and I was shocked to read this 2 days ago, an article on a website called firstthings.com, which is a Christian evangelical, I think, publication. And I saw it circulated a lot, titled Say No to Death's Dominion. And this is what this guy said. This is one Christian response that supports Trump on the idea of saving lives versus shutting down the country. Quote, there's a demonic side to the sentimentalism of saving lives at any cost. Just so, the mass shutdown society to fight the spread of COVID-19 creates perverse, even demonic atmosphere. He goes on to talk about, you know, like the Spanish flu, and he goes, you know, Americans were struck by a terrible flu pandemic that affected the entire world. Their reaction was vastly different from ours. They continued to worship, go to musical performances, clash on football fields. Unlike us, that generation didn't want to live under Satan's rule. They insisted that man was made for life, not death. They bowed their head to
50 million people on the earth died.
I thought it was 100 billion. Now,
that was a lot of people.
But during that same Fox town hall weirdness that Trump did, he talked about the Spanish flu. And he's like, yeah, like 100 million people died. But he was saying it had like a 50% mortality rate. It didn't. The Spanish flu had a 2% mortality rate.
No, it was higher than that. We don't know the exact numbers, but it was definitely higher than 2%.
I read afterwards that from people responding to that particular clip that it was 2 to 3%.
If I recall right, it had 2.7 like total mortality, not case mortality, like earth.
Oh, I mortality. See. Earth mortality. Okay, then that makes
sense. The case mortality was like, I think probably somewhere between like 4 and 10 or something, but still 50-50 is insane. It was not that. It was not right. Ebola.
But Trump was making this argument. He's like, all these people die in car crashes every year. You know, it's, I mean, he's people making all these
the
ridiculous
flu. I mean, also we should care more people dying from the flu. But on the other hand, like, I mean, it's just, it's a death cult. And people, it's really, I cannot get over the fact that our solution to a difficult problem is a widespread reaction of like, eh, let them die. Just keep going like normal. Let them die. So yeah. It goes, it, whatever.
Just everybody get back to work. Now, here's what I'm wondering about these briefings. They're supposed to be for the coronavirus team. Is Trump on that team?
I mean, he's there to give them orders and like, where's, I'm sure he goes to some of the meetings, but probably he's not at them. He doesn't care about the actual work.
So can we talk a little bit about people who are on that team who should be maybe tempering what this president is saying to the public?
We can, but first I want to share you a tweet that Trump just sent out.
Oh, to God, right now? Okay.
The lamestream media is the dominant force in trying to get me to keep our country closed as long as possible, in the hope that it will be detrimental to my election success. The real people want to get back to work ASAP. We will be stronger than ever before. Oh my God, kill me now. This is so fucking dangerous. This is so fucking insane and dangerous and stupid. And it's like the worst, unfunniest episode of Veep ever.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, he's basically saying, like, that the country, like, the reason that we're trying to have a shutdown is in order for the Democratic media establishment to try and destroy Trump.
That, and also I saw this morning that, I can't remember what Republican senator was like, oh, they're trying to, the Dems are creating this chaos because they want to have mail-in ballots, and so they want to rig the election.
We need mail-in ballots, if it was only for 2020, like, at this point, fine, like, we should have it in general anyway, but, like, the problem is Republicans know that universal suffrage is bad for them, so they'll fight anything that is like that. But we cannot guarantee an actual election in November unless we have this.
Right. It's, and there are some folks working on this in Congress right now to I think Amy Klobuchar is
Republicans
one of
those. Republicans will never agree to it because they know it's like fatal to their chances of winning.
Yeah, I think Amy Klobuchar is one of the senators working on it. And by the way, her husband has been on a ventilator for the last 2 days now. So
I'm very curious. Like, this virus seems to act different ways in different countries. Or at least the way we're reporting data now is not giving us the full picture, because the U.S. experience so far suggests that it is much more dangerous for younger people than we have believed from the Chinese data.
Unless we're just not, exactly, unless the Chinese data is not accurate. But also, I don't think we've seen anything similar from Spain or from Italy.
We don't have, Italy has been very much, well, it's the second oldest population on Earth, but it's very much skewed towards older people there. We don't have data from other countries so much yet. We know, like, for South Korea, the fatality rate's very low. But I don't know.
And also, doctors can't seem to figure out how it's operating differently in just different people, because I've now known about, basically, the people who are dying, like, I'm like maybe 1 or 2 degrees separation from people who have died in the last few days, like my friend's friend or my friend's friend's father or something like that. And in many instances, these were younger people. There's a 26-year-old man here in DC who just passed away. No underlying health issues, no pre-existing condition. You know, what we've been told is that it's either older people, somebody with underlying health issues. But there's something, and then it's happening very rapidly, apparently. So somebody feels a little bit under the weather, they're having some trouble breathing, and within like 2 days, everything shuts down.
And they're found dead in their rooms. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's apparently, and so I want to ask Sarah about this, Dr. Sarah Qureshi, who'll be on with us later. So, all right, let's talk about the doctors who are at the top now in the country.
Oh boy. So Dr. Fauci and Dr. Birx are the two most prominent, I guess, scientific or expert advisors on the coronavirus task force. And basically, America's been clutching on to them like a lifeline. Dr. Birx is, there's a great article today on her like style and how she has sort of made, not a name for herself, but like positioned herself as like the voice of like nursely or like school marm authority with style. And it's right. It's what she, like, she has definitely forged a sort of a unique position in how she presents herself as an expert and is, you know, deferential, but also still takes control. But at the same time, her, much more than Dr. Fauci, I think, has just totally ceded all willingness to speak truth to power, which is not her job. Again, like, all these people, they have to be deferential to the person in charge. Like, they can't, it's not their goal. Like, they can never be in a position of directly undermining the president. Right. That doesn't help anyone. But
let me ask you this, Susan.
Yeah.
Why not? Why not get up there on one of these briefings and be like, this man is going to fucking kill everybody. You can do it once, but here's the thing. You resign, and then you go out and you repeat it over and over and over and over in every media outlet out there. If you want to really save lives, I understand. Yes. If they don't have, here's what I say. I think they're valuable inside the administration as long as they're able to shape this guy's thinking and what he's going to do. If they have no influence and impact on the president, get the fuck out of there and help us out here. Like, get out here and be like, we had to leave because he's going to kill us. I'm okay with them working for the administration as long as they're able, but I feel like they have, like, now in the last few days, they've got no control over him.
Yeah. And now if they quit and did that, it would mean nothing because they've been too ingratiating, been too much a part of the system. So everyone dismisses, like, oh, of course you said that now that you're out of the administration. Would the power would have come from at a point when you realize that the truth is not being heard to resign publicly and, like, say why in a very, you know, just based on the facts only.
At the mic, at the press briefing.
Yeah.
That's how they should do it.
But that point's gone for both of them. Now they are just tools of the administration.
No, I think they could still do it.
No way.
I'll tell you why.
Everyone would be like, oh, here are all the quotes all the times when all these media shows and, like, said fawning things of the president.
But it's changed. What's changed is that this week Trump is like, open the shit up by Easter. That's a big shift.
Okay. But
so
also,
they could say on this point,
that window's,
like,
closed. They waited. If Dr. Fauci had done it yesterday, maybe yes. But he missed that chance. He's not ever going to do that either. He's a survivor. He's a Rosenstein. They're not ever going to do that.
I want to say to someone like Dr. Fauci, listen, you've served six presidents. You're in your 70s. Go out like this. Go out by preserving your legacy.
He still thinks he can do more from inside. He's wrong, I think. But maybe he's right. I think, like, he's the expert in all this. So.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, maybe there's ways that they're able to have an impact behind scenes that we don't know.
But right now, the reason they're still there, the reason Trump keeps them there, is because they help him. They give him this aura of, like, oh, at least we have real doctors in charge. This is the experts there. They use him as cover for his, like, most ridiculous statements in order to give them cover and credibility. They steal Dr. Fauci's credibility and expertise to defend the stupid shit Trump says. And in doing that, they undermine Dr. Fauci's role, too.
All right. Well, let's talk to a doctor who's not going to do any of that, Dr. Sarah Qureshi, and we'll come back and cover some of the additional points we want to talk about today. So I'm really excited that we have on our show a guest, as I mentioned earlier, and I want to tell our listeners a little bit about Sarah. Sarah Qureshi is, first of all, the better half of our often recurring co-host, Wajahat Ali. But Sarah is also a doctor. She's a graduate of the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine and Harvard School of Public Health. Last week, some of you might have seen her on CNN, maybe it was earlier this week. Everything's a blur. But anyhow, Dr. Qureshi is a professor at Georgetown. She has done a fellowship in community health, which is exactly what we're talking about now. She's also an advisor at the Hoya Clinic, which is a Georgetown student-driven free clinic. And Sarah is just a lovely, lovely friend. And just thank you so much for coming on and for, you know, listening to our concerns and our panic here.
Oh, thank you for having me. Like I said, I am a big fan of your podcast and of both of you.
So, Sarah, are we all going to die?
Oh, well, no, we are not all going to die, but it is pretty bad and a lot of people are going to die.
Sarah, can I tell you, I want to talk a little bit, and Wajahat has talked about Nuseiba from last year. Your daughter last year, Nuseiba, underwent, she battled and won her fight against cancer. She had a liver transplant. She has, she's compromised, her immune system compromised. So I know this is something you've been watching very carefully. So have you been staying home with her, taking care of her? Are you, like, in the field working with patients here? What's going on?
Yeah, so I am, and maybe this is part of why I feel like I need to do my job and educate the public. I'm not in the field right now. I was on maternity leave when all this happened, and I'm actually going back to work in the next week, officially starting back. I've been off the past year taking care of Nuseba, then had the baby in November and on leave. So when I do go back, though, I'm only going to be seeing patients through telehealth or e-visits. That's what our clinic is transitioning to, first of all, because healthcare providers are at such great risk, which we can talk about a little bit later if we want. But the second reason is I am terrified of bringing coronavirus home to Nuseba. She is on immunosuppressants and her immune system is compromised. And we've been through such a rough year, and it would just be so traumatic to bring that home to her, because she is really vulnerable and at risk. So I am fortunate in one way right now that I'm able to do that, and I'm not officially on the front lines in the hospital. But I want to play my part to at least educate the public about this and relay messages from all my colleagues across the country who are on the front lines and who are the superheroes of all of this.
Is telehealth something you did before this, or is that sort of a new coronavirus development?
This is absolutely a new coronavirus development, at least for our clinic. I know a lot of clinics were starting to do that, and you'll see all these apps out for telehealth in the past. But what's happened now is for well visits, or visits that aren't coronavirus related, or triaging patients, which means they're not sure what they have and they want to talk it out with somebody. All of these outpatient clinics are transitioning to telehealth. And I think that this is going to change the face of medicine, because we're going to realize, wow, we can do a lot of the things we do without always being in clinic every single day. So this is absolutely new for all clinics.
So I have a question. This is something Susan and I were actually recording before we got on with you, and we're going to go back to finishing up some other things. But we were talking a little bit about, like, it seems like in the United States, we're seeing more cases than we heard of, at least over internationally, of younger people getting sick, not just getting sick, but even dying from people in their 20s and 30s and 40s, which before it really hit America hard, like we kept hearing it's really the elderly who or people already have underlying health issues, have immune system issues.
Healthcare providers from China. We'd see some examples of young people dying there.
What are you seeing, and what are other healthcare providers seeing, like in terms of like young folks?
So, you know, well, absolutely. I'm sure you guys might have already gone over this, but we're at about almost 65,000 cases as of today. And that when I say reported, that means there's still so many thousands who haven't been tested. And we're at about 900 deaths. So this is hitting our country, and it's hitting really hard. So as far as the age, what we're seeing here is the CDC did put out a report that where they looked at cases here in the U.S. from mid-February to mid-March, and the prelim description basically shows that in the 20 to 44 age range, we are seeing actually about 14% that are hospitalized, which is higher than they were seeing out of China. And so if we're looking, you know, at about before when I was doing the math, I mean, that ends up being a more than right now, currently more than 60, 70 people who are hospitalized in that age group. Again, that does not mean that they're all dying, but it just means that younger people and even people who don't have other vulnerabilities like hypertension, diabetes, immunocompromised, they're still at risk. And I'm hearing reports from colleagues all across the nation. One of my colleagues in Boston was like, we just intubated a healthy 45-year-old guy, no underlying medical conditions, coronavirus. So I'm hearing this from colleagues across the nation. And you are right to mention, though, that healthcare workers are at greater risk. That what this hypothesis is that they're being exposed to higher levels of the viral load because they're around patients with coronavirus all the time. And unfortunately, because of our government's failure, we don't have the proper personal protective equipment. And so we are seeing a lot of young healthcare providers who are intubated in the ICU. I just saw a report today about 16% of cases from Ohio are healthcare providers.
So what counts as a pre-existing condition for this? I mean, I don't understand how people are over 30 and don't have some kind of pre-existing condition. So like what counts as pre-existing for purposes of coronavirus?
Well, so coronavirus is a virus that actually, so it affects the upper respiratory tract and the lower respiratory tract and goes straight down the lungs and really just attack the lungs really aggressively, causes fluid in the lungs, and then patients can't breathe, and it can happen really rapidly. So anybody with any, first of all, any underlying lung issues, such as asthmatics, those with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, smokers, and we think that's why the numbers were higher in China for men than women, although we're not completely sure, but because there's such a large percentage of the male population who smokes there. So smokers, lung transplant recipients. So that's one category. There's a lot of others. We're finding those with underlying diabetes and hypertension. We're finding that coronavirus can also result in cardiac arrest affecting the heart, resulting from something called cytokine storm, which basically is a medical term where your whole immune system is just like in a storm and attacks your body. So anybody with underlying heart issues, they're also quote unquote pre-existing condition or vulnerable. Anybody who's immunocompromised, whether it's from an autoimmune condition, whether it's from having a transplant like our daughter, whether it's somebody who's undergoing chemo right now who has cancer, all of those people are at risk. So that's just some of the categories.
Man, I got diagnosed with asthma 6 months ago. Like, that's some great timing, body. Couldn't you have put it off for like another year?
My eldest daughter has asthma, and you know, my husband had Hodgkin's lymphoma many, many years ago, and I was talking to him about this, and he said, well, "Okay, no, but that this is for people. I think I've been in remission for 15 years. I'm okay. I don't think that's counted as an underlying issue. Like, that's like, you know, I should be okay because I'm not currently like in chemo. I don't currently have it."
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a new virus, and the only numbers we have are 4 months old, reports coming out of China and other countries. So yeah, hopefully he should be fine. But I think I still would say any cancer survivor might be a little bit more at risk than somebody who didn't have cancer in the past, if that makes sense. But it doesn't mean he's one of the high risk people.
Sarah, can I ask you, what kind of response have you seen from your colleagues to what we're hearing from the president in the last 2 days, which is he wants to see the economy reopen by Easter. He wants people back at work. He wants us to just start moving again.
Oh my gosh. It's everybody is horrified. My colleagues, other people who understand what's going on. We are just absolutely horrified. It's really like watching a train wreck in slow motion and seeing it happen and really not be able to do anything because you have a leader who is incompetent and doesn't understand or who values money over lives. I don't even know where to start with his latest, with what he said. But the bottom line is we can work hand in hand to do the right thing from a public health standpoint and also address the economic impact of shutting everything down. But the bottom line is, if we do not shut everything down now, it should have been done months ago, weeks ago. If we don't keep at the social distancing, if we ease the restrictions, we are going to see spike in cases, more deaths, our healthcare system is going to implode. I mean, I'm not trying to be dramatic. This is what's going to happen. I mean, with every delay or misstep, it's measured in lives lost. And I was telling this to Watch the other day, but I teach first-year medical students in one of the courses I co-direct. We every year do this emergency preparedness / pandemic workshop. And honestly, unfortunately, the U.S. is going to be a case that we're going to use to teach of what not to do in a pandemic. And that's heartbreaking for me.
One of the things I was surprised by is I wasn't surprised so much that we did run into shortages of like PPE and other medical equipment. But I was surprised at how quickly we ran out of the basic stuff like ventilators. I mean, that could have been, yeah, that was obviously a problem, but things like gloves and masks and just the gowns. I mean, I guess in my head, I think like if, as this went on, we'd have shortages of that, but we're in the barely beginning stages of it and already we have vast shortages. What causes that?
Well, I mean, that's multifactorial. I'd say, first of all, you're already looking at a healthcare system that's broken and that is stressed. I mean, just as before even COVID-19, our healthcare system is, you know, overburdened, is stressed, is broken. So you already have that. And then on top of that, you have this immediate demand for so much. And what one of the negatives that happened is the public went out and stockpiled up on all of this stuff. So that really harmed our healthcare workers because then there wasn't enough supply because everybody hoarded so many of the masks. That's one. Number two, China is where we get most of these supplies. And clearly they've had such a disruption for so many months, right? So you can see how all of these things piled up together has led to a shortage. But we could have prepared. Like, we knew about this pandemic as far as the government is concerned back in January. That is the time. And if we would have actually had a pandemic task force, which was in place during Obama's years and dismantled under our president, current president's leadership in 2018, if we would have had a task force, that would have been one of the first things they would have said, let's prepare for this. Let's be proactive rather than reactive. I mean, our healthcare system, as it's been, it's always like we're trying to put a Band-Aid on things. And I feel like we're doing that same exact thing in a pandemic, except it's going to be much worse in a pandemic. It's like we're reacting and it's far too late. We could have been prepared. We could have had the testing. I mean, if you look at countries who have been successful in flattening the curve and decreasing the rate of infection, South Korea, Taiwan, they tested early. They had enough PPE for all their healthcare workers. They quarantined, they tracked cases, they did really severe lockdowns. And now they're slowly like going back to normal life. Look at us. This is going to affect us for even longer and hurt our economy even more.
There are confusing cases though, like with Japan. They are the oldest population, even older than Italy. And they are not doing widespread testing, more than we were at the start, but they weren't doing like the kind of testing South Korea was. And yet their numbers are, I mean, I don't want to say impressive, but like, yeah, they've had a supposedly, you know, successful response to this virus, despite having all these factors that would seem to indicate disaster.
Yeah, you know, you're right. It's affecting each country differently, and it depends on the population. They do have a aging population, but I do believe that the rate that we're seeing is low is honestly also because they're not conducting extensive testing. So I don't know how this is going to play out long term.
I also think there's cultural factors. I think there are certain cultures in which people are much more, they get together much more frequently. They're much more, the families are bigger. There's a lot, and there are cultures that in which people are a little more isolated and independent. And I think that can also have an impact. And I have no idea. I'm not an expert. It's just a theory.
Well, it's certainly more culturally okay to wear masks in Asian countries.
Sure.
Exactly. No, Rabia, those are actually really important points. I mean, as we talk about health, we have all these scientific facts, but so much that's at play is the culture and how people interact with each other. And over there, it's normal to wear masks or they take their shoes off before they go into homes. And there's just, you know, so many other things that also play into this that we don't like, you know, have defined out right now, but you're right.
So let me ask you this, and this is not in response to anything from Trump, but I'm seeing, you know, we have friends we know that likely have gotten the virus given the kind of symptoms that, you know, they've been sharing with us. What kind of symptoms should people look out for? And then how do you respond to, how do you know it's time to go to the hospital, step aside of your house, take this seriously, or you just nurse yourself and stay home because nothing's going to really happen if you actually go to a hospital? How do we react to this? I think in the next couple of weeks, we all have to have this information.
Yeah, no, you know, Robbie, that's an excellent question. And I think it's easier for us as physicians to like say these things, but it's really hard to practically know what to do if you're not a physician and you're a patient in this scenario. So basically the symptoms that we're seeing primarily fever, and this is, again, a lot of this data is coming out of China, but we're seeing similar things here in the US. More than 80% of patients present with fever. The next most common symptom is dry cough, so more than 60%. And when I say this, I have to say other upper respiratory infections not caused by corona SARS-CoV-2 can cause those also. So keep that in mind. But fever, dry cough, fatigue, and sputum are also present. Shortness of breath in about 20% plus cases. And then you can also, like, there's 5% of people who present with vomiting, diarrhea, sometimes with sore throat, headache, chills, body aches. So it's kind of a constellation of symptoms. But again, fever, dry cough, shortness of breath are the big ones. When to come in. So right now, what we're asking people is if you have a fever and you're taking Tylenol and it's responding to the fever and you just have a cough and you're able to breathe okay and stay at home, then please stay at home. Because the last thing we want you to do is come in and infect others in the healthcare system or infect the healthcare providers, especially if you have mild symptoms and don't need to be hospitalized, because they're not going to do anything for you. And right now we're still short on testing kits, despite what the press briefings are saying. All my colleagues are still having a hard time getting tests. So, I mean, it's better than it was before, but like I'm saying, it's not readily available everywhere. So again, if it's mild symptoms, meaning you're still able to breathe okay, and you're having kind of like common cold, like you feel like it's a cold and you're kind of achy, you can stay home and just use supportive measures, Tylenol, rest, stay hydrated.
And what do you do with other family members? I mean, if I keep thinking about this, if tomorrow I have a fever, does it even make sense to self-isolate inside the house when I've already been all around my family and kissing them and touching them and holding them? And
I know. You know what, Robbie? You're right. And because you can actually spread the virus even before you're symptomatic. The incubation period is anywhere from 2 to 14 days, on average 5 to 7 days. So you might have already spread it to them. But even with that said, I still think it's smart to kind of, at that point when you are feeling symptoms, to isolate as much as humanly possible. And again, I know it's hard. I have young kids. I've thought about that too. I'm like, oh my God, like, you know, we've been kissing each other and hugging and playing and, you know, but do your best, especially if it's possible for you to like be in a room and just like kind of isolate in that room. That is what is advised. Again, is that practical? That's not that practical, but... And I want to get to your point though. So when to go in and seek care, what is scary about this is patients can get pretty sick pretty fast. Like I said, this virus goes down, it attacks the lungs pretty quickly. If you start to feel pretty short of breath, if you're like, wow, I can't breathe as well as I used to, or I'm breathing a lot faster, or have to work harder to breathe, or I'm using a lot more muscles to breathe, that would be the time, again, with any of this, call your primary care doctor and talk it out with them, even if you just have the fever and dry cough. But especially the shortness of breath, call your primary care doctor and they can ask you some more questions and advise you whether or not to go, you know, what to do. But I'd say at that point, probably go to the ED. Again, you know, calling your doctor. If you don't have a doctor, then maybe going to the ED. Because if you're already starting to feel short of breath, then I think it makes sense for you to get checked out and hopefully get tested at that point. Mm.
Okay. Thank you so much for that. Susan, any last questions you've got before we let Sarah go?
No, I mean, it's kind of practical advice is what we're not getting from the Trump administration right now. Like just these stupid briefings they have every day. You think they could at least include this kind of information in it?
Give us a one pager, damn it.
Yeah, let Trump have his rally and then have like a, like, okay, by the way, guys, here's what you do when stuff goes down. Yeah.
Well, I would recommend watching Andrew Cuomo's morning briefings for New York. Those are actually really great and really informative and evidence-based. And, you know, unfortunately, we have our leader like throwing out names of medications that are promising, which is really irresponsible. Because what that has led to is, one, shortages of those medications for people who actually need them. And I've heard from colleagues and patients that they're not able to get them because they're running out, because people have ran to pharmacies or asked doctors to write prescriptions just in case, right? And number two, it's also led to some overdoses. These aren't mild drugs. And if you take it, it can interact with other drugs and it has side effects such as heart arrhythmias and other things. The press briefing, you know, and again, the data on the study that showed that drug was really, it was out of France. It was a really small study. And these drugs still need to go through phase trials in order to get approved. Yeah, we are using them in the hospital for very sick patients, but nobody outside of the hospital who's sitting at home should go buy these medications. So unfortunately, those are the kind of things that are coming out, or false reassurances. And it's just frustrating.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for giving us your time. I know how incredibly busy you are. Maybe, hopefully, we can have you back sometime soon to, you know, follow up. We're always going to be, you know, at least for the next few months, going to be very...
This is going to be a long-term issue.
Yeah, this is going to be a long-term issue. Stay safe. Much love to you and the kids. And thank Watch for letting us have you for a little bit.
I will. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate all the work you guys do.
Thank you so much. All right. So, well, we had a great talk with Dr. Sarah Qureshi. Thank you again, Sarah, for coming on. We hope to have you back sometime soon. This episode has gone really long. So, Susan, we know that we'll have plenty more of this to talk about next week. So we're going to save the rest rest of the issues for next week, and we'll come back and talk about kind of where we are with medical supplies, with the funding bill. Hopefully we have something at that point. And maybe somebody will find a way to shut Trump up between now and then.
No.
No. Okay.
Too much to hope for.
Well, stay safe, Susan.
A miracle cured, more likely.
I hope the sun comes out for you. Pray for me to stay away from carbs as much as I can. It's not working well. But anyway. All right. Thanks so much. And hopefully we'll be back in 7 days. All of you guys, stay safe. Stay inside. Stay home. Take care. A big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is at 45th Pod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345, and you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.